Hey everybody, the Sausage to Science episode that you're all here for will be on in just a second. But I want to tell you that the HBA annual meeting is coming up March 20th and 21st. The program is now online and you can go on and start figuring out what sessions you want to go to. And guess what? We are doing a new initiative with the Public Relations Committee of the Human Biology Association. We're going to be posting little pictures with a little bit of information about a lot of the members of the executive committee. And what we hope is that you'll engage with us when you see us at the meetings. So don't be shy. Come up and say hello and tell us about you as well. Can't wait to see you all there. Hey, Courtney.
Hey, Chris.
What you doing?
I am actually looking at flights to Samoa to do some pretty cool tattoo research.
Look, you start off as a webmaster, you become a co-host, and suddenly you're going to Samoa. Thank you for that. I'm really excited. Let's see. We have questions for, however, today, who are we talking to today? He's right there in the waiting room, as though I don't know.
We're talking to our very own Eric Griffith.
Eric Griffith, who is a postdoctoral associate within the Duke Center for the Study of Aging. He got his PhD from UMass Amherst. He was a student of Lynette Sievert, one of our own. He also has a MA in psychology from Boston University, and he completed his dissertation field work in central Mexico, focusing on the experiences of family caregivers for people living with Alzheimer's. So we'll talk to him a little bit about that today, as well as some new research that he has submitted for publication. It'll hopefully be part of a special issue of American Journal of Human Biology devoted to the role or the influence of religion and spirituality on human variation. So his interests are biocultural anthropology, dementia, cognitive aging, health disparities, and mixed methods research. And of course, Eric is one of our junior service fellows and does much of the editing for these things. Shall we bring him in?
Yes, absolutely.
What's up?
Hey, how you guys doing?
Welcome to your episode that you will edit in a minute. How are you?
Good.
Good. We have a question for you before we get started. Tell us the name of the book that this chapter's in.
Oh, my goodness. You know, it was the one they gave away at the conference last year, actually. And it was just a review of it in AJHB last issue. I think it's like Anthropological Perspectives on Aging.
Who's the editor?
Brittany Howell. Couple of your other former podcast guests, I believe, had a chapter in it too.
I don't remember. I think I went to this book for another purpose and found that you were in it and was like, that son of a bitch never told us.
I did. I gave the presentation on the chapter at the conference last year, and I had a picture of the book in the slides.
And I was indisposed, probably talking to someone in the hall, and missed it. And I remember Christina came out and went, Eric just gave the best talk. And I was like, shit. So we had to have you on the podcast to make up for that. And you can tell the whole world about it.
Okay. Sounds good.
All right.
All right. So Eric, while you were in the waiting room, Chris gave you the most amazing introduction. It was very impressive, very amazing. But you do know the routine, so can you tell us all about the ingredients that go into Eric as an anthropologist and a dementia researcher?
So I started my academic career at Boston University, and I actually went as an undeclared student, and I didn't really know what I wanted to do. And I took a class because it was at a good time, and it had spaces open on African literature with Professor Heidi Gingenbach, who I believe is at UMass Boston now. And she was not, I don't think she was actually an anthropologist, but I believe she did some field work and had a very anthropological mind in the way she taught. And I went to her one day and said, hey, I don't know what I want my major to be. These are the things I like to do. And she said, have you tried anthropology? And I said, I do not know what that is. So I took Anthropology 101 with Professor Parker Shipton, who is still at BU. And I loved that class. And so I switched over to anthropology as my major and finished out my bachelor's at BU. After that, I worked in a day job at the university, and I got a master's in psychology. As you know, you get tuition remission as a staff member. So I took advantage of tuition remission and just went after a master's in psychology. I liked the brain part of psychology a lot, and I liked the like going out into the world and like learning things part of anthropology a lot. And so when I was applying for grad school, I'm like, I want to put those things together. So it seems like maybe biological anthropology is the way to go. Professor Lynette Sievert at UMass Amherst was kind enough to take me on. And so we went from there, and I did some field work in Mexico, interviewing people living with dementia and their caregivers. So that was how my sausage of science was made.
Where are you from originally?
I am from Oregon.
Wow. So how'd you get from Oregon to Boston?
It seemed like a fun, you know, you're 18 and it just seemed like a fun thing to do to go to college. Some people want to go to college nearby and stay with their friends. And maybe this is the anthropologist in me coming out. I was always more interested in going on an adventure. And so the idea of moving 3,000 miles away and living in a new city for the first time that I'd never been to was just really exciting.
Let's get to your research. And so let's talk about the book chapter that you have out. It's in Anthropological Perspectives on Aging, edited by Brittany Howell and Ryan Harrod. And you gave a talk based on this at the recent HBA meeting, which everyone was raving about. It's called Recruiting Participants for Dementia Research Without Saying Dementia. That has to be a little bit difficult. It's sort of like working in Samoa, studying Samoan bodies without saying weight or something like that. Yeah, can you tell us a little bit about that? What that means?
Yeah. So, and this was some of my naivete as a grad student at the time. I was very much under the impression, okay, I've gotten some good advice on like how dementia works in Mexico, how it is culturally constructed. I feel ready to parachute into this for me new city again, parachute into a new city, just like when I was going to college and talk to people, and I'm going to make this work. And I thought I had done my homework. I had gone there a couple times, and I had taken the time to speak to some physicians. And Lynette from UMass, my PhD advisor, put me in touch with a family there. And I spoke with them about recruiting strategies. And they more or less said, you know, if you just like give some public talks, just kind of get out there and say you want to talk to people with dementia, it will go well. It did not go well initially. There was not as much openness to discussing dementia as I had been led to believe by some of the folks I had talked with ahead of time. And that's no fault of theirs. I think they maybe just had a different frame of reference than what I wanted to do at the time. And so I had to improvise, because dementia, there's enough of a stigma on the word that it's seen as synonymous with craziness in Spanish, at least in that part of central Mexico. And so I had to talk around it a lot to get people willing to talk about how their cognition was changing as they were aging.
You talk about the obstacles with conducting this research. And I know a lot of us who have conducted research before know that recruiting participants can be one of the most difficult aspects, other than securing funding in anthropological research. I know everyone's nodding like, yes, there's always funding problems too. But can you talk to us a little bit about the obstacles specifically that you encountered while trying to recruit participants?
Yeah, so a lot of it was, again, I was coming into it as a U.S. researcher, and I maybe wasn't coming at it from the best angle, thinking I could just engage with people in public and they would start talking to me about dementia. A lot of people didn't have a formal Alzheimer's disease diagnosis like they might in the United States, and I wanted to make my study more scientifically valid, so I constrained it specifically to Alzheimer's disease. So I needed folks who had a specific diagnosis. And since diagnosis-seeking practices are different in the U.S. versus Mexico versus other countries and so forth, you can't necessarily assume there's going to be a lot of people who are formally diagnosed and that you're going to be able to get a hold of them and that they're going to be willing to participate. So I ended up, instead of seeking out people on my own, I did some seeking out on my own, but I partnered with a physician in the area who was doing dementia outreach already, and she was willing to work with me. And so she would have people who she had diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease who were interested in participating in research, and then she would set me up with them, and then I would enroll them into my research. And so that was a really good relationship we had, kind of helping each other out with our shared missions.
So I want to back up real quick, because I think that studying aging is or aging is one of the understudied aspects of human biology, right? Especially because we fetishize evolution. And so we sort of focus on things that might be directly evolutionarily salient. So one, I applaud that you're studying this as an aging human. But also I want to ask why. What motivated you? What got you interested in dementia and cognitive decline as a research focus?
I really don't have a, I know a lot of people have a really good and compelling answer to this. And I often talk around this because I don't have a good and compelling answer. The honest truth is I liked doing anthropology and I liked the neuropsych classes I took during my master's. Like I liked the developmental neuropsychology a lot. And I wanted to put those two things together. If you look at funding streams, there's a lot of funding in dementia research right now. So it was just kind of very much a, I like doing this type of work. What topic is at the nexus of all of those things? And dementia was a good option. I'm not necessarily married to the idea of continuing to do dementia research. I really like the idea of studying cognitive aging in general, because there's, as we experience aging, the way our brains function changes over time. And so there's tons of, you know, non-dementia, I don't want to say impairment, but like normal aging changes in our brain that could be studied further, I think. And especially with an evolutionary perspective, there's all kinds of evolutionary questions you could ask about brain aging.
I think that's a great answer, actually. Most of us, we come with some personal interest, and then we have to force our personal interest on a population and convince them that they need us to study it. So you're actually addressing a need, doing more, I guess, what's called biomedical anthropology, where there's a need and you're doing it. So that's awesome. So I'm gonna ask a low-hanging fruit question to give you the opportunity to talk more about, as you said, there's not a lot of diagnosis necessarily for Alzheimer's disease in Mexico. The stat in your article you quoted was that 90% of participants in Alzheimer's disease clinical trials are non-Hispanic white people. So it sort of suggests that Alzheimer's disease is primarily a white person problem. Is that true or not true?
No. And in fact, we see that once you, when you do population level analyses and actually screen increasing numbers of people, we see that underrepresented minorities are diagnosed with dementia and Alzheimer's at higher rates than white people within the United States. This is specific to the United States. You can look, for instance, at the Alzheimer's Association 2023 Facts and Figures report, and they'll show they'll break it down by race and ethnicity, and it will show I believe Black people in the U.S. have the highest rates of diagnosis. Hispanic people are in between, and then white people are at the bottom or towards the bottom as far as prevalence. And obviously there's tons of biocultural factors going into that, since dementia risk factors, something like 40% of dementia risk factors are considered modifiable as of the last meta-analysis in The Lancet in, like, I think 2021. So there's a ton we can do to reduce dementia risk. And that's why there's race and ethnic differences in the United States.
So just one clarifying question to make sure we're on the same page. Why are white people more frequent in clinical trials?
White people are more frequent in clinical trials, again, for a huge number of reasons I think most of us are familiar with, but a lot of it has to do with access. The lab I'm at Duke right now, I'm not really on this project. I'm part of the lab, but there's other people doing the recruiting. It's specifically recruiting Spanish-speaking people, or at least Hispanic people in this area, to participate in research, because they have historically, there have been barriers that have been bigger steps, hurdles to get over for a lot of Hispanic folks in this area. Language barriers, for instance, not everyone here speaks English. And so we have both of our CRCs speak Spanish, so they're able to do outreach in Spanish and recruit people in a different language. A lot of our research is around a 9-to-5 job. We know that there's disparities in the types of jobs people have. We saw this during COVID. It's a lot harder to participate in research if you are not working a regular 8-to-5 or 9-to-5 and you don't necessarily get vacation time and whatnot. If we want to get specifically into the dementia space, there's other types of underrepresentations. I may be getting this backwards, but the there are often familial caregivers are often either spouses or adult children of the person living with dementia. participation rates in research differ depending on the relationship between the person living with dementia and then their caregiver. So the people who are participating don't necessarily, the dyad doesn't necessarily have a relationship that is representative of the majority of people. And again, that's because there's different priorities for spouses than there would be for adult children. Adult children may be part of a sandwich generation where they have to go to pick their kid up from daycare, so they can't shuttle grandma to the clinical trial, or they can't, you know, they're still working, whereas a spouse is retired. So a spouse may be able to go to an 8-hour neuropsych workup to enroll into a clinical trial.
So you just listed a huge list of hurdles that, you know, really prohibit recruitment. But can you talk about like stigmas as well that surround Alzheimer's and related dementias and how that could negatively impact, you know, recruiting and research?
So there has been a lot of stigma around cognitive changes dating back to at least the 70s and 80s in the United States, and obviously before that. And so the idea of someone having Alzheimer's disease carries that weight, and that will stop people from wanting to go to get a diagnosis because they don't necessarily want to hear they have it. It will stop people from wanting to talk to a researcher because they feel embarrassed. And then also once they have it, it changes relationships with spouses and with other family members. You'll see, we have I think it's called, I forget who wrote this paper. There's a really great paper on what we call narrative collisions, which is when a spouse is diagnosed with dementia, their priorities relative to the other spouse are now changing because their relationship is changing. The spouse may be becoming a caregiver in the near future. And so that's a huge, huge piece of turmoil. It's essentially you're entering into another liminal state of life at the age of 70, 75 years old. And so that makes it very, very difficult to expect people who are experiencing that transition to be like, cool, I'm going to go talk to the anthropologist down the street now.
Oh my God, I don't mean to laugh. It's so tragic. And yet, yeah, that's the last thing any of those folks probably want to do. So you're probably relieved a little bit then on the current project that you're not the person doing the recruitment, but I just want to sort of toggle a little bit back to that chapter. And you call the problem or the difficulty of recruiting a recruitment crisis. And I couldn't argue with that, right? I wonder if you have any insights from your experience that could help ameliorate that, or
you have to do, we know this as anthropologists, but I think as a grad student, you maybe underestimate the amount of homework that you need to do once you arrive in a place. So you have to, I think a benefit of doing research where you start to collaborate with people who are already in the community is it does two things for you. Number one, it reduces the risk that you become an unethical researcher because you're speaking with people who are living there and who are telling you what they want and or need. Some people just, you know, they want to engage their community in research, and that it's as simple as that, whereas other people want some kind of exchange of resources or information or whatnot. So I think as anthropologists, the thing we have to do is we need to get in touch with someone who's doing something similar in that area and then work with them on their terms and then integrate our project into their terms instead of vice versa. Very difficult as a grad student if you're going there with Wintergreen or NSF funding and you have a list of objectives that you're supposed to be meeting, but still doable. The second part is you have to improvise. And so the way I improvised was, since dementia carried a negative stigma, I worked with a physician that I was collaborating with on better terminology. And so we came up with the terminology of normal versus abnormal aging. And we framed it that way to say, okay, are you experiencing these cognitive changes? This is normal aging. Are you experiencing these cognitive changes? This is abnormal aging. If you're experiencing the latter, come talk to the doctor afterwards if you'd like to get some resources on what's going on and what to expect, and have her maybe work with you a little bit on that.
I love that. I love the article. I've had similar experiences when I was in my doing my graduate research among Pentecostals, studying dissociation, right, which is what scientists call the psychological state that speaking in tongues takes place in. But I didn't call it dissociation when I was talking to them, but I had a poster for AAA, and somebody looked me up and saw the name of it on the poster, and then everything shut down. Nobody would participate in my study. So I ended up talking to the pastor. The pastor's like, oh, they're going to rip you a new one if you go approach them, because, you know, like they looked you up, and I'm like, oh man. So I ended up having this conversation with them that was, it was a turning point in my research, very, very similarly. And I say that story because it gives us a segue to our next article, which you sent in, which is about religion and spirituality and the influence of religion and spirituality on dementia among aging, in this case, Black Americans. So I am super interested, as you know, in how religion and spirituality could be effective. Tell us about the importance of religion and spirituality in the Black community. Why would this be an obvious variable in a study of health outcomes?
Yeah, and a glance behind the pod, this paper is under review at a journal we all know. I can't say the name since it's only under review. Obviously, I will edit the show notes with a link, hopefully in a month or two, in a few months if I get rejected and I have to resubmit it. So this is something that I hope will be published soon, and the title will hopefully be Religious Participation is Associated with Fewer Dementia Diagnoses Among Black People in the United States. The reason why religion and spirituality are a particularly important variable for many Black people in the United States is because religion plays an outsized role in relative to other races and ethnicities for many Black people because of historical antecedents. We all know the history of institutional racism. We all know the exclusion of minorities, and particularly Black people. So the church, the predominantly Black churches have historically stepped into that vacuum and have done a lot to provide religious and spiritual, but also practical support for many Black people, including giving out health advice, including bringing in nurses to do blood pressure screenings, those kind of things. And so the predominantly Black church for many congregation members is a source of information, education, motivation, and so forth because of exclusion from formal systems in the past.
You used the health and retirement study data set. Can you tell us a little bit about the nature of the data?
Yeah, so the health and retirement survey is one of those. So actually, if we have any grad students listening, I'll just back up a little bit. So there's primary data analysis and there's secondary data analysis. Most of us kind of choose one path or the other. I've done a little bit of both. Primary data analysis is when you go get your own new data, you're collecting brand new stuff and you analyze it, write it up like many of us do in our dissertations. Secondary data analysis is when you acquire usually a larger data set from often a company or a university. In this case, the University of Michigan runs the HRS. And the benefits to secondary data are they are often longitudinal. And so you have the Framingham Heart Study is a classic one where they've been following people for decades, and they've been collecting data from the same people and sometimes even multi-generations of people for decades. And so the benefit to this is you can get that long-term longitudinal data. Often it's harmonized, often it's controlled. The procedures are all written down for you. And you can do types of analyses you could never do because it would be impossible for you to single-handedly survey thousands of people over the course of 20 to 30 years. The HRS was chosen for this particular analysis by the PI, Keisha Bentley Edwards, who hired me as a postdoc at the Samuel Du Bois Cook Center on Social Equity. The reason for that was because it had several measures of religion and spirituality in it. It had an oversampling of older Black adults, which a lot of these secondary data sets don't necessarily have. And then it had a cardiovascular disease health measures, which was what the goal of the big picture grant, the R01 that I was hired on to, was looking at cardiovascular disease health. And I was specifically looking at dementia. And so there were part of a subset of those cardiovascular disease health questions was dementia. So it kind of just checked the boxes that we needed to run an analysis like this.
So one of the questions or one of the interests that I have is in the nuance of religion and spirituality. I argue article that hopefully will appear alongside yours in the same issue, that we include religion as a minimal sort of affiliation or frequency of religious attendance variable. So this study asked frequency of attendance, frequency of prayer, and religious salience. I would interpret frequency of attending as sort of an extrinsic or a public religiosity. And I think you speak to this in the discussion and the religion, like the daily prayer, especially because I think it was prayer outside of the church setting. And then intrinsic religiosity, the questions seem to get at sort of like, is religion guiding you in your daily life? Which I think of as as intrinsic religiosity. Can you tell us, if that's true, I'm curious as to your perspective on those, what was found, what you found in regard to those nuances?
Yeah, and again, this is secondary data analysis, and so something that Chris is getting at that I think important is that measuring religion and spirituality is there's many different ways we can do it, and so we are limited by the tools that we have when we get a secondary data analysis. And so I wouldn't necessarily have constructed it this way. I probably would have come up with a more comprehensive questionnaire. But when you get the secondary data, the best you can do is attendance, prayer, and then I created a variable, or I didn't create it. Our statistician suggested a variable for salience, which was taking the mean of several other variables that ask questions like, do you believe in a higher power? Or there's a higher power. I think it was like, there's a higher power guiding us in life. And these are validated measures that have been used a million times. And so that was closer to spirituality. What we found was that the more often that these Black older adults are reporting that they're attending religious services, the less likely they are to be diagnosed with dementia. The prayer and salience variables did not have the same signal. And so in the analysis we ran, it was really attending church made a difference for someone's odds of being diagnosed with dementia. And so there's a couple different ways to interpret that. Number one might be that that's a cumulative effect, that the people who are attending church less or more often later in life are attending church more often the entire time, their entire lives. And so they gain some kind of social support, maybe, for instance, some kind of health advice that reduced their dementia risk. The alternative interpretation is that when someone's diagnosed with dementia, they become stigmatized. Sometimes it becomes more difficult to continue with your daily activities. So it's possible that, because this was a cross-sectional analysis, we didn't have longitudinal data on these variables, but it's possible that the people who are living with dementia are reporting they're attending church less not as an antecedent to diagnosis, but as a consequence to diagnosis. In which case, I still think this finding is interesting because there was no difference, again, on the prayer and the salience. So no matter what, older people who were living with dementia, they were saying that the prayer and salience were still very important to them, to the same level of people who were not yet diagnosed with dementia. So in that case, it means that these people are possibly losing access to church after being diagnosed with dementia, which is, again, if this is a major source of social support and support, maybe educational support, all kinds of support throughout your life, you're diagnosed with dementia and then you can't go to church anymore, or you don't feel comfortable going to church anymore, that's a big impact. So either way, it speaks to the role of religion for people living with dementia and how we have to make sure that we make religion accessible for people with dementia.
That's incredibly powerful. So your piece is under review right now. And speaking of spirituality, I'll say when it is accepted, I'm going to manifest it when it's accepted. What do you hope readers take away from the piece?
I don't know how often we talk about religion and spirituality as a modifiable risk factor for dementia. We talk a lot about all kinds of lifestyle factors, such as nutrition. So if you have, I don't want to say poor nutrition. If you have nutrition that makes you more at risk for cardiovascular disease, you're also going to be at higher risk for dementia. We know that. There's a huge amount of data on that. People with experiencing hearing loss, they also are going to be diagnosed at the population level at higher rates than people who are not experiencing hearing loss. There's a signal now we're seeing blindness too. So visual impairment maybe affect your dementia risk. We can go on and on with modifiable risk factors. I think a lot of times the way that they're presented, they're not necessarily presented with a pure biological determinist point of view. But I think that tends to be in casual conversation the way it goes. So if you eat the right kinds of food, you're going to improve your biology by being, you know, by maybe reducing your risk of obesity, reducing your risk of stroke or heart attack. So now since your biology is improved, your risk of dementia will decrease. I like the religion and spirituality variable in this particular analysis because it's kind of, you know, it's kind of not the opposite of that, but it's a lot harder from when you're talking colloquially, talking on a non-science podcast for someone to say, oh, well, you're just fixing your biology to reduce your dementia risk. No, it's going to church that's reducing dementia risk, maybe. And that's just such a more culturally salient variable in casual conversation that I think that's really helpful.
So I'm not going to ask you to explain this, but I want to put a pin in what you just said with your own quote, which is that religion, spirituality, or R/S, is not a race-neutral determinant of health. And I think that was made clear in your articles and in talking to us today. So let's conclude by finding out more about you. What are you up to next? You're in a postdoc? Are you on the market? Are you headed off to greener pastures? What sort of research is on the front burner for your next project?
Yeah, so I'm on a T32 at Duke University. So I have another year and a half in this postdoc. So I will be looking for jobs. So either a career development award or hopefully a faculty position somewhere sometime soon.
All right. Any universities out there listening, Eric's about to be on the market. Hire him. Thanks. He's the best.
Let's
All right.
So.
You know what's coming, my favorite part. My favorite part of the interview. Next month, we will be in Los Angeles for the Human Biology Association conference. If we were able to reinstate the talent show, what could we expect to see from you?
I was stressing about this question because I knew it was coming and I don't have any I am not athletic. I am not musical. I'm not particularly good at like cooking. My life skills are like analytical. Like if I can't think about it, I am going to struggle. So I was trying to think like, what could I translate that to? Like I like to hike a lot, but like, I'm not like, you know, I'm not like a professional, like I'm not an orienteer. So I can't say that's something that's a good talent. The closest I can get is I'm really good at managing our household's food. So I'm like an A+, like I really like doing mental math. So I'm like walking around the grocery store, like adding up calories and price and like doing like, you know, what food is the most efficient right now. I get home and like, I have a like immaculately organized fridge. So, and I have all of the meals planned out for the week. So I know we're not going to waste any food. I don't know how you would translate that to a talent show. I guess we could set up a grocery store and we could see who shops the most efficiently. So I think that food management in a capitalist hellscape is probably my hidden skill.
You're like speaking to my soul. I'm so crazy about my refrigerator and my pantry. I will take photos and send it to people. And I'm like, here's some fridge porn. And like, it catches everyone off guard. So yeah, for our group chat that we have, I will definitely be sending fridge porn because I feel like you would appreciate it.
And you know, when I realized that my fastidiousness around food was I was taking a anthropological field methods class with Krista Harper at UMass, and the first activity she had us do for a photo voice unit was take a picture of our fridge and upload it and then like write three sentences about it. And everyone was like, Eric, your fridge is like ridiculously organized and clean. What happened? Like, are you just like between grocery shopping trips? I was like, no, this is just normal. That was like the first moment that I became self-conscious of that my fridge was weird.
I opened up my fridge and this morning to, I don't remember what I was getting out, and like seven things of like dog food that are not open fell right out onto the floor in front of me. There's like half leftovers that somebody didn't wrap up, and I'll take my picture too, so it'll horrify you. And maybe you can come over to my house and do some organizing. Anyway,
that's going on a rant.
Eric, thank you for joining us on the Sausage of Science today. If there's anyone interested in reaching out to you, I know you're a private dude. Is there a way they can find out more about your work and maybe ask you some questions?
Yeah, so email is the best way. It's eric.griffith@duke.edu. I will put my email in the show notes. I'm always open to conversations about collaborations or just fun conversations about the way that older adults think. So, yeah.
Awesome. Email. Thank you. You can find me on Twitter @Chris_LY or on any of the other socials. Just Google me. Courtney, what about you?
I'm on X as HolyLeeTolly. I also have a website, HolyLeeTolly.com, and you can find me on Instagram, Facebook, wherever. You can also just Google me.
And the Human Biology Association is humbio.org. You can find Twitter, humbioassoc. We now are on Instagram as well. Forget the name of that. But yeah, just check it out, everyone. And
cue outro music.